It's Morning Edition on 90.1 WABE. I'm Dennis Sohair. The American Bar Association is one of the most influential organizations in the country. Its new president is from Atlanta. Linda Klein is senior managing shareholder at Baker Donaldson. She became the ABA president August 8th. Linda Klein joins us now. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
You're starting your term with an initiative to get more legal services to more military veterans. But how are they different from other folks who also have trouble getting access to the legal system? That's a problem whether you're a veteran or not, isn't it?
It is true that 80% of poor people lack access to legal services, and yet half of the people who do qualify for legal aid are turned away. Veterans, though, are a unique population. They return home after persistent combat exposure, redeployment, separations, and they encounter a variety of legal problems, such as evictions, child custody disputes, wrongful denial of benefits, credit problems. Veterans Affairs Department study found that half of the top 10 legal problems that lead to homelessness among veterans cannot be solved without legal help. And so this year, the American Bar Association and lawyers throughout the country are coming together to help this unique population that needs help so much get more help.
In what ways?
In many ways. We're going to be working on medical legal partnerships that pair VA facilities with lawyers to solve clients' legal problems. We're going to be promoting veterans treatment courts. In fact, there are 20 veteran treatment courts here in Georgia already. And we're looking to expand veteran treatment courts to include areas that are not criminal, like civil matters such as debt collection and domestic relations.
And do veteran treatment courts handle things like, let's say, a veteran is abusing drugs, for instance? Is it that kind of thing?
Usually what happens is a veteran will have a problem such as a drug or alcohol abuse, and that leads to a criminal arrest. And so in the encounter with the criminal justice system, those who are very well trained, often judges who are veterans, work with the veteran to try to get them into a better position, and so they can come off of drug and alcohol abuse and back hopefully into gainful employment. Some of the other things that we're working on this year are promoting legal checkups for veterans and their families and caregivers. You don't hesitate to go to a doctor once a year often for a medical checkup. But since so many people, veterans and non-veterans, find that problems they have are legal problems, but yet they don't know that the problem is a legal problem. We have nearly 40,000 homeless veterans in the United States. And in Atlanta, we believe there are 700 homeless veterans in the city every night. We had a situation that I'm familiar with where there was a Vietnam veteran. He was an infantryman. He was homeless, and he was living under an overpass at Georgia 400 in Sandy Springs. And legal aid got the Veterans Administration to work on his benefits so he could maintain his independence. And now he has a home and lives quietly in Cumming, Georgia, and is not living under an overpass anymore. 13% of our nation's heroes live at or near the poverty line, and the lawyers in the United States intend to do better than that. And that's why we've chosen to help veterans, because their untreated wounds can lead to so many problems like homelessness, like the loss of a job or housing. I learned that the fastest-growing homeless population in America is women veterans.
Does this initiative, though, mean at some point having to take on the Veterans Administration over some of the problems that vets are having with the VA, whether it's treatment delays or some of the episodes where something falls through the cracks and a veteran commits suicide? Is there any limit on how far you can go, perhaps even in confronting the VA?
There's no limit. When lawyers take on a problem, lawyers take on the entire problem. I've already met with the General Counsel of the Veterans Administration and other leaders in the VA, and so many of them are willing to work with us. The VA does not view this effort as by any means controversial or confrontational with them. They legitimately want to help, and we intend to work with them to do that as best as we can.
Obviously, there are going to be points where the veteran's story and the VA's story conflict.
I can tell you that there are several stories. One, for example, a Korean War veteran from North Georgia. He was combat wounded. He had a Purple Heart. His initial disability rating was 30%, and he, for 40 years, was working with the VA to try to increase his disability rating. At over 80 years old, he was having a problem living on what was offered to him, and through 4 years of effort, a legal aid attorney got his disability rating increased, and now at the last years of his life, he has the comfort that he needs. So certainly that's what lawyers do.
This means a lot of pro bono work, and that is one of the issues that many lawyers have to confront. Are we going to see that kind of pro bono work being done across the board, since veterans live everywhere and there are a lot of places where there aren't the kinds of legal services available so that the lawyers can even handle that much pro bono work?
Yes, I understand what you're saying, and that's why through the bully pulpit of the American Bar Association, we're mobilizing lawyers all over the country. Annually, the ABA works on a national celebration of pro bono. We begin that the last week in October, and this year we're extending that through Veterans Day, November 11, and we're asking lawyers all over the country to participate in pro bono events to help veterans get the legal services they need.
Because a lot of impoverished veterans live in places where there are few lawyers to start with, so will you have enough attorneys in the places where they live, though?
Often that has to be done through the internet and through the telephone, and that can be done very successfully. The ABA had a program called the Veterans Claims Assistance Network, VCAN, and that was in cooperation with the VA to help bring down the backlog that you heard about in the number of claims. And that was done by pairing lawyers and their new clients through the internet and through the phone. And it worked very well in reaching those clients. But one of the things that I've been thinking about since access to justice in rural areas was something that was important to me as chair of the ABA House of Delegates, which is the policymaking arm of the American Bar Association, where I served. And we're going to look at bringing incubator-type programs to rural areas where lawyers who need some experience can work with impoverished communities, hopefully with veterans, in those areas to bring them the access to justice that they need. There are some clinics for veterans here in the Atlanta area that I thought I could mention. Emory Law School has a volunteer clinic for veterans. The Georgia State University has a volunteer clinic for veterans. And the website, if lawyers are interested in volunteering between now and November 11, is probono@gabar.org. That's probono@georgiabar.org, gabar.org. And a veteran who is looking for help can go to georgialegalaid.org.
A related subject is not just pro bono work, but legal aid services in general. And while there's a lot of funding at the federal level, here in Georgia, there has been an ongoing issue of underfunded public defenders. And Georgia's not unique in that. Is the Bar Association getting involved in battles at the state level during your term to increase funding for public defenders?
It's true that there's a lack of adequate funding to provide legal representation for persons in the criminal justice system and also in juvenile delinquency cases. These people have a constitutional right to a lawyer, but they can't afford representation. And as a result, we've seen here in Georgia and elsewhere, public defender agencies and their lawyers are routinely faced with enormous caseloads. And these public defenders are unable to represent their indigent clients effectively as required by the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution. That requires, of course, competent and diligent representation consistent with the professional rules of conduct. So in 2009, the American Bar Association issued 8 guidelines of public defense related to excessive workloads. And these contain a well-thought-out course of action, not only for public defender agencies that are forced to deal with too many cases, but also for other providers of indigent defense services that have excessive workloads. Nearly two-thirds of the states have some sort of statewide commission that oversees indigent defense. And the ABA resolution that has dealt with that issue has been in place since 2005, and that calls on
state governments to provide increased funding for the delivery of indigent defense services in criminal and juvenile delinquency proceedings. And the funding should be in parity with the funding for the prosecution.
And a lot of prosecutors are underfunded, too. So
that's true.
The question is, if the guidelines have been in place since 2005 and the issue remains, what more can the ABA do if it feels like defenders are still underfunded?
We continue to bring this to the attention of the United States Congress because the United States Congress can appropriate funding for the justice system and does in several different ways. You mentioned civil legal services, and there are many other ways in that. On a state level, we rely mostly on state bar associations, but we give the state bar associations and in the local bar associations, for example, the Atlanta Bar, people are familiar with a large local bar association, we give them the resources that the ABA has developed to use in their own state legislatures.
Is there a risk at some point, and we're starting to see it in some cases anyway, where courts have ruled in individual cases that the person didn't have adequate defense because his or her lawyer wasn't able to take the time to do it, that the public defender was simply overburdened. And then you're faced with somebody who may or may not have committed a crime, possibly a serious one, getting out. On the other hand, that person may or may not have had an adequate defense.
And that's a problem. And that's why we need to fund the criminal justice system adequately.
So what is it going to take? I mean, even in this recovery, state budgets, and Governor Deal has said, you know, departments here in Georgia shouldn't be asking for a whole lot of money despite increases in revenue because of increases in expected costs across the board.
One thing that Georgia has been a leader with in the country is criminal justice reform. And in fact, we were lobbying Congress this year. Every April, the American Bar Association goes to lobby Congress. And one of our issues that we lobby on every year is civil legal services. And the second issue that we lobbied on this year was criminal justice reform. And indeed, we were able to talk about Georgia as being a model in the criminal justice reform system. There are people who are nonviolent offenders that were sentenced under rules that no longer are state of the art, let's say. That maybe the nonviolent offenders did not need to be in jail for as long as they are, and that frees up time, money, resources to prosecute the people that need to be prosecuted and need to be put away for long periods of time.
Here in Georgia, there's a drive to overhaul the state's Judicial Qualifications Commission. That's the watchdog agency for judges. More seats under this proposal will be given to the legislature to appoint. You are from Georgia. Does the ABA have a position on this?
The ABA believes that judicial qualifications commissions, although they have different names in other states, should be independent. And so the ABA has model rules for judicial disciplinary enforcement, and these were adopted by the ABA House of Delegates in 1994. They've been around that long. And it talks about a judicial qualification commission or a judicial disciplinary enforcement commission, as they may be called in other states, to be established by the highest court or the legislature and through a constitutional provision to make it free from interference from any branch of government.
Does that rule out legislative appointments?
It doesn't entirely rule out legislative appointments. The ABA believes that the commission should have 12 members. All of them would be residents of the state, that four of them should be judges of appellate or trial courts that would be appointed by the Supreme Court, and that four should be lawyers, and that four should be neither lawyers nor judges appointed by the governor. That's how the ABA views the best practice for a judicial qualifications commission.
As I understand it, Georgia's doesn't exactly follow that. So does the ABA have a position on what's going on here?
The ABA's position would be consistent with the policy that I just read you.
So you'd rather see something else?
The ABA would, and as president of the ABA, that's the policy. The most important thing, though, about a judicial qualifications commission is that it be independent and free from influence.
Is the ABA afraid that this won't be?
The ABA has not studied the positions that are on the ballot this coming November. But since I mentioned the ballot this coming November, I will tell you that another one of the ABA's positions this year, one of our initiatives, we talked about veterans, but also it's voting. I've heard that this might be the lowest voter turnout in American history. And the ABA believes that lawyers have a duty to protect the right to vote as a cornerstone of our democracy and essential to the rule of law. So the ABA has launched a nationwide initiative that asks all lawyers to be advocates for voting. And we're not only going to encourage all lawyers to vote, but we're asking that they ensure that their staffs have adequate time off to vote and that they encourage their clients and their communities to vote. We've got a website called VoteYourVoiceNow.org. And on there, on that website, is a map of the United States. You click on any state, and it gives you the rules in that state on voter ID requirements, voter registration material. And there's the kind of information that you need if you're an employer, how much time you need to give your employee off to vote. There's also a video that we've got for schools to encourage young people to vote. And all of that can be found on VoteYourVoiceNow.org.
Does that initiative, though, also include taking positions or advocating for or against some of the voter ID laws here in Georgia, in North Carolina, which is under challenge, or around the country?
The ABA believes that elections should be fairly administered and that all persons eligible to vote should be able to do so. The ABA's adopted guidelines that help jurisdictions ensure the administration of a fair election process. And the guidelines are fairly detailed. The most important thing to know is that the American Bar Association is a nonpartisan association. It deliberately does not make any donations to political candidates. It never endorses candidates. It has no PAC. We have a standing committee on election law. It's carefully balanced between members affiliated with each of the two major parties. Our current chair is a lawyer from Albuquerque, New Mexico, who's done work on redistricting and election and ballot contests on behalf of Republicans. Our immediate past chair is an election lawyer from Washington, D.C., who's primarily done work with Democrats. So as you can see, we keep everything very well balanced.
But is there a position on voter ID legislation in general?
No.
Your election as Bar Association president was actually historic in a way because, although you're not the first woman to be president of the American Bar Association, you are the first woman to succeed a woman. Your predecessor, Paulette Brown, visited with us on Closer Look just about a year ago, and she told us for her initiatives that most young people believe that the justice system is unfair, whether it's for police shootings or the school-to-prison pipeline, other issues. Has the ABA, in her term and into yours, taken some concrete steps to restore some of that confidence among young people? And what do you plan to do in your term?
It's interesting that you mentioned that because Paulette, as she was leaving the presidency and I was becoming the president, we started to put together a commission that's going to be looking at public trust and confidence in the system. And we're putting that group together right now. And hopefully within the next 6 months, I can come back on the show and tell you exactly what it is that they found. But these are very important things. All Americans need to have trust and confidence in our judicial system.
One of the ways to improve confidence in the legal system, particularly among disadvantaged youth and minority youth, is to get more minority students to consider the law as a career.
Absolutely.
What is the ABA doing on that front, especially when it comes to the elite schools, which is one of the pipelines to successful law firms?
The ABA has a fabulous commission on the pipeline, and that's what we call it. We actually call it the Education Pipeline Commission, and they work all the time on the issue of making sure that more young people have an opportunity to go to law school. The ABA has a law school opportunity scholarship fund that lawyers throughout the country donate to. I met a woman who was originally from Macon, Georgia, and she's now on the board of governors of the Washington State Bar Association. I was sitting next to her at a dinner, and she told me her story. She was a homeless teenager, and through the ABA's scholarship fund, she is now a lawyer in practice in Tacoma, Washington, and on the Board of Governors of the Washington State Bar Association. I'm very proud of that. The ABA also has a judicial clerkship program for minority law students so that they can work in the court system with judges. And that creates maybe some aspirations for the judgeship for minority law students, which is also very important because our judiciary must reflect our nation.
One of the concerns has been, particularly as enrollment in some law schools has been declining, that, okay, the elite schools are going to fill their seats. They're going to be able to get people. But others may be less selective in order to boost their enrollment. And that's led to further discrepancies in the quality of representation that you can have when you can afford it versus when you can't.
The declining enrollment in law school means that fewer people are interested in law school, fewer people becoming lawyers, but there haven't been enough of them out of school from this, because this is a fairly recent development, for us to see an effect in representation at this point. And if you pass the bar, you are competent to handle cases. And in Georgia, of course, we have a mentorship program where all new lawyers have mentoring. And that's not true in other states. I'm particularly proud that Georgia does that and invests the time and energy in making sure that all new lawyers have a mentor. So I believe that in Georgia, the quality of lawyering will always remain high.
You know, obviously one of the questions that the profession struggles with a lot is if you've got money, you can afford a great lawyer. If you don't, it's harder. And if schools are trying to fill seats, does that gap between those who can afford good representation and those who can't just get bigger?
So I think there may be two different concepts in here, and we can go through them one by one. But the first concept is that we're just filling seats in law schools. I think you've seen that most of the larger law schools have begun shrinking their classes so that they can maintain quality. And, of course, the bar examination is one way that we maintain quality of lawyers. The ABA has worked very hard on making sure that when people choose to go to law school, they know what the commitment they're making. There's an opportunity cost for 3 years out of the labor force, or if you maybe don't go full-time, there's an opportunity cost for going to law school. And then there's the cost of going to law school, which can be very, very expensive, particularly at a private school. And so everybody needs to be prepared for the sacrifice that you make to become a lawyer.
Are there enough scholarship programs like the ABA's to attract enough folks from all different walks of life, all different parts of our demographic spectrum?
No, I don't think that we're coming close to the amount of scholarship money that we'd like to see to make sure that everybody who wants to become a lawyer, who's qualified to become a lawyer, can get to become a lawyer. I often tell people that becoming a lawyer may be a good way to make a dollar, but the real reason to become a lawyer is to make a difference.
Are you seeing more young lawyers leave the profession? I hear that anecdotally. Do we have numbers to back that up?
I believe that we have numbers to back up the fact that particularly young lawyers of color leave the profession or especially leave private practice in law firms.
Why?
We are examining law firms. And we need to know what about law firms doesn't attract millennials or what about law firms doesn't keep and attract a diverse population of lawyers. It's a very big problem and one that the ABA continues to study.
What kinds of things are you hearing from just folks anecdotally, you know, like I am? I just hear burnout, burnout, burnout.
Burnout is not necessarily the question that I hear. In our own law firm, I'm very proud of the things that we do to make sure that diverse lawyers are fulfilled in what they do. Pro bono activity is one thing that keeps lawyers glued to a law firm. And we try to make as many different pro bono activities possible from whatever might interest someone. And that can keep the fire burning in the belly for making a difference.
You said the ABA does not take stands in terms of partisanship or voting for candidates in elections. But one of the hot issues for the last few years in elections has been the number of judicial vacancies, particularly in the federal system. Confirmations in the Senate, including President Obama's most recent Supreme Court nominee. Does the ABA have a position on this, and is it saying one side or the other, one party or the other, needs to get off the dime here?
The ABA, since the Eisenhower administration, has been evaluating candidates proposed by the president for federal judgeships. There are well-qualified, qualified, and not qualified. Those are the three criteria that we use. The ABA has a committee called the Standing Committee on the Federal Judiciary. It works in totally independent of the ABA politicians, such as myself. So when they're working on their reports, I hear nothing of it. I just know that the president's nominated someone. Often I don't even know that the president has nominated someone until the report is given. Unfortunately, we have had the number of judicial vacancies, federal judicial vacancies. There are 89 that are vacant now and 5 more that are going to be vacant by the end of the year. That's over 10% of the authorized judgeships that are now vacant. And that creates a problem because high caseloads strain the justice system. It deprives litigants of their opportunity to resolve their civil disputes in a timely manner. This has terrible consequences for American business and for individuals who are holding their personal lives and their business lives while they wait for their day in court.
So are you saying that in this case it's the Republicans blocking the nominees of a Democratic administration? Does the ABA go that far?
The ABA doesn't quite go that far because on September 6th, I wrote a letter to both Senator McConnell and Senator Reid, the leaders for both parties, and I asked them to take action on 20 district court nominees. Some have waited as over 300 days, and many have waited over 200 days. And when I look at the list of the 20, several of them come from states that have two Republican senators. For example, Idaho and South Carolina are two states that have two Republican senators, but those are judicial emergencies. That means that there's only one judge active in those states right now, and they need another judge to handle the caseload. So we have asked, the ABA has asked under my signature, for the Senate to take these 20 judgeships. These are trial court judgeships. These are not appellate court judgeships. We're not talking about the Supreme Court nominee right now, but to please get these 20 judges confirmed. They have all come out of the Senate committee with great bipartisan support, and they're ready for a vote.
Why do you think it's not happening?
There have been comments that there's not enough time left in the session to vote on the pending nominees, or even if it were available, it's just customary to stop confirming judges at this point in a presidential election year.
That's certainly been an argument made in the case of Judge Garland.
Well, the ABA disagrees with both of those statements. The ABA appreciates the time constraints under which the Senate is going to be operating for the remainder of Congress. But the Senate will not have to spend undue time on confirmation if they schedule votes on these multiple non-controversial nominees on the same day. Right now, they tend to schedule one or two votes at a time. And in my letter, I ask Senator McConnell and Senator Reid to schedule 6 confirmations at a time. And there's precedent for that because that was done in September of 2011. There's ample precedent for confirming multiple district court nominees on the same day during the final months of a presidential election year. And there is a Congressional Research Service that has that data, and I've made that data available to Senator McConnell and Senator Reid. What's very important about confirming these nominees is that if they are not confirmed before this Congress adjourns, then we're going to waste a lot of taxpayer time and a lot of taxpayer money because we have to start all over again in a new Congress.
You said that there's ample precedent for confirming judicial nominees in the last part of a presidential election year. Now, your letter doesn't cover Judge Garland's nomination to the Supreme Court because that is a very controversial one. But in general, do you think that principle that you outline, that there's ample precedent for a vote, applies to Judge Garland?
In my letter, I chose to focus on the way we could do the most good the most quickly. And in that letter, I'm looking at trial courts where most Americans are affected, particularly where there are judicial emergencies. There is ample evidence of the Congress acting in the past. 9 district court nominees were confirmed in October of the last year of the Reagan administration. 4 were confirmed in October in the last year of the Clinton administration. And 10 were confirmed in September of the last year of the George W. Bush administration.
And those are the trial court nominees that you're talking
Correct.
About. Yeah. But as a general question, and I know your letter doesn't refer to Judge Garland, do you think the same principle applies in his case?
The ABA has reviewed Judge Garland. The ABA committee, this independent committee, has rated him well qualified.
Linda Klein is the new president of the American Bar Association. She is from right here in Atlanta, where she's senior managing shareholder at Baker Donaldson. Thanks so much for being with us, and congratulations again.
Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to coming back.